Before you head off on your summer vacation, we'll have some tips on tipping etiquette during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will discuss which services warrant tips and how much. He'll also have some tips if you are in the market for a new grill. And he'll explain the buzz around crowdfunding and answers to your personal finance questions as well. Call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So I have a code. How are you?
Better than you for once.
Yeah, I guess. So are you heading off on a fun summer vacation?
Yes, I have this awesome plan where for the next 13 weeks until fall, I will pretty much go to work every day and then go home. So I had a travel agent help me with the plans, and it was more expensive this way, but it worked out perfectly.
Well, before we all head off on our travel and vacation plans, we thought we'd take a look at what kind of tipping we ought to do when we're on vacation and what kind of tippers we are. How do Wisconsinites rate when it comes to being tippers, Kevin?
According to Square, which is a payment processing company, they analyze tens of millions of transactions. And Wisconsin residents are fairly in the middle of the road like we usually are. The average tip for Wisconsin residents for Square transactions was just a shade under 16% of the bill, but that put them in the bottom third of states. Alaska led the way at 17%. Delaware was down at 14%. And of those who tip, Wisconsin was a lot closer to the top. 55% of Wisconsin residents did leave a tip for the transactions. Illinois led the way at 61% of residents leaving tips. And again, Delaware was down at 38% of those who left tips. Now, there are some issues here. The processing, of course, is credit cards only, so we weren't able to track payments in cash or tips left in cash. And a lot of people do leave tips in cash because it gets into the server's hands more quickly usually. But it still is a good reason to look at the issues and of tipping, and there's a lot more that goes into this, especially from the server's side of the equation.
Well, let's talk a little bit first about what kinds of services and products are tippable.
Well, it's much more prevalent in the United States than it is overseas. A recent study found that 31 different types of services or products are considered to be tippable in the United States versus maybe 10 to 12 in Asia and 14 to 16 in Europe. Overseas, it's usually, especially traveling and dining out, it's much more inclusive. It has the tip already figured into the bill. And especially when you are traveling, you've got the airfare, baggage, you've got the hotel, you've got cabs, you've got other types of services. And then you have a delivery bringing food, whether you're at home or on the road. And then finally, dining out, which is where the rubber really hits the road.
But these tip recipients are also paid by employers. So how does this calculate?
Very rarely are they paid very much. The tips are usually already figured in as part of the employee's wage when the employer is calculating the wage. And in fact, according to the federal law, servers only have to be paid $2.31 per hour if a majority of their wages do come from tips. That's from 1996. Now, that varies according to state, and often there's a law in place that says if they don't make at least minimum wage between their hourly wage and tips, then the owner does have to boost up whatever they do get paid for a certain period of time. But according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, most servers usually only make about $8 to $10 an hour, depending on where they're working and the type of work that they're doing. And you have to keep in mind, even when you give a tip to somebody like your server, you're very happy with the service, the meal, etc., and you leave 20% or whatever, that server often has to break up the tip between the bartenders, all the other low-wage people, bussers. Everybody has to get a portion of that tip, so the server usually doesn't get the entire amount that you leave.
Yeah. Well, what are some rules of thumb when it comes to tipping what type of service?
It depends on the type of service. Excuse me. If you're leaving some change for a cup of coffee, especially if you go into for a barista, $1 to $2 is fairly reasonable. However, if you're ordering, I know you get the triple half latte, mocha, steamed.
Two of them,
mm-hmm. Right. And then, this isn't right. Could you go back in and do this one again? If it's a very complex coffee order, you might want to leave at least $3 or so. If you're at the bar, $3 to $5 is good, depending on the amount of work. Again, popping open 6 bottles of beer is not the biggest job in the world, but if you're ordering a Grasshopper's for everybody and margaritas where there's a blender involved, you might want to leave $10 or more for the tip. If the person is bringing something to you or taking something for you, whether it's luggage or they're bringing food to you, delivery, $5 to $20 is usually fair, and especially if you want to go, just keep $5 bills with you if you're traveling. That makes a nice little tip for people handling your luggage, etc. Dining out, at least 15 to 20 to 25%. A lot of people feel like there's been tip creep, you know, where it used to be a tip 10%. Got up to 15, now 20% is really the norm. Again, part of that is because of the law that allowed the wages to be lowered for workers, so they're expecting more in tips. And in service, workers like a hairstylist, massage therapist, what have you, usually want to tip about 20% of the value of the session. And then at the end of the year, if you have a regular relationship with this person, maybe the value of one session. For instance, if you go to massage every couple weeks or so, and at the end of the year, you want to tip the massage therapist, and at $60 or so, you might want to give another $60 just as the tip. And you can always offer an S. It can be a little embarrassing, but it's more embarrassing to say, "Oh no, thank you, I don't accept tips," or whatever, rather than be that person who doesn't tip at all.
Yeah. So when I rent my cottage on the Bay of Green Bay, when I go to Door County, there's no housekeeping going on there. I don't have to leave the owners of the resort a tip for for that, do I?
Yeah, you know what? It doesn't hurt, and it depends on if you had a really nice experience. They're not going to turn it down. They're not going to send your $10 back to you and just say, "This was really nice." And you're not completely sure that they're even the ones doing the cleaning. They might appreciate it, but they might farm that out as well. And that person definitely, for a hotel service worker, you know, if everybody left an extra dollar or two, or $5 for someone who's cleaning a room, that doesn't mean that much in the scale of the big purchase. You know, if you're spending $100 or $150 on a hotel room, another $5 isn't that big of a deal. But for that person who is cleaning those rooms and might be cleaning a dozen rooms in that given day, an extra $5 in that person's day per room is a huge benefit. So try to just lean a little bit more towards generosity, and again, err on the side of being a good tipper.
Kevin McKinley is a big tipper, and he is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and doesn't represent that the securities or services that are discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234. We have an open line for you. You can also email your question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. Time now for the On Your Money email bag, and we're not dipping into the email bag today as much as we are going to Facebook. A listener named Ray sent this via Facebook. Could you please ask the amazing Kevin a question? Sure. My son and his wife have huge school loans. My daughter-in-law is doing her residency, but loan payments have come due. They cannot make any payments with their current income, so they deferred the loans. However, the loans are accruing interest of $30 a day or $11,000 a year. She has 4 years of residency, so this will add up to $44,000 of interest. So, Kevin, they want to know what to do. And coughing.
I don't blame them one bit. They want to know if they can cash out of an annuity or loan them the money for now, according to the email. That can be a very good idea. But I would prefer that if they're going to help them out, that they don't cash out of the account completely. Instead, it's a more low stress and low key way to help to actually just make the payments for them. In the sense, you could say, hey, where do the payments have to go? Give me the book. I'll start making the payments for you for the time being for it. And what that does is that allows them to stay current on the loans, help eliminate the buildup of the interest, and keep the flexibility and protect themselves so that if they need that money down the road, they don't have to try to get it back from their kids, who by definition, for the time being, probably aren't going to be able to repay them on the spot.
What if they're still set on paying off the loans?
They may want to check in to a home equity line of credit if they have equity in a home. They can either establish the home equity line of credit or a home equity loan to borrow against that equity. They will not only get lower payments, and if they get a new mortgage, they might extend the loan out for a long time, which will lower the payments as well. The interest may be tax deductible to them as well, and overall the family will probably pay less by borrowing against the home than the kids will pay by keeping the student loans and paying them off and having the interest accruing.
What if they'd rather tap into their investments instead?
Then they might want to split the withdrawals from these big lump sum distributions. If it's from an annuity, all the earnings are going to be taxable. And if it's from a retirement account, of course, any withdrawals are going to be taxable. And so to kind of break up the tax hit, they may want to pull enough out in 2014 so that they can stay in the lower federal income tax brackets. Again, the 15% federal tax bracket ceiling is about $74,000, and that's the number on line 43 for married couples filing jointly. So they might want to pull out just enough to make sure they're staying in that bracket. And then after the first of the year in 2015, which sadly is less than 7 months away, they can pull the other portion out of that. And at least they'll divide the tax hit up among 2 years and probably lower what they'll have to pay overall in taxes to pull that money out. Now, if they do give a lump sum to kids in this situation, I'd really like them to see a lawyer and for sure have the loan documented up. The lawyer can do it for them. It's probably going to cost about $500 to $1,000, depending on the complexity of the situation. If they want to do it themselves, they can go to a place called loanback.com. Loanback.com, for about $30 or so, you type in the terms of the loan. It prints out a nice legal document that everybody signs, so you've got some agreement as to how this is all going to work for it. But you want to have yourself protected in this case, in case the kids get into bigger financial trouble. You're a creditor of theirs, and so you want to make sure you're first in line. And knock on wood, but sometimes all marriages end in death or divorce, and if it ends acrimoniously, there might be some question as to who owes what back to the parents.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and if you have a question for him, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kathy in Antioch, Illinois is with us. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I had a question regarding the tax advantages of donating a vehicle and then how you choose an organization.
Well, let's see. What organization are you listening to right now, Kathy? Where are you going for not only quality information but entertainment as well? You can donate to Wisconsin Public Radio, but there are lots of other organizations out that do accept vehicles. It's actually a little trickier process than just saying, here are the keys and the title to the vehicle, in part because it's a much cleaner and a more above-board process, but there was some abuse of it, over a decade ago. And so the IRS really cleaned it up, and you can get a break on the value of the vehicle. It's usually not going to be a huge break for you, but one of the things it does for a lower-priced vehicle, if you try to sell a $500 or $1,000 vehicle, it's very difficult to do it because a lot of people say, well, it needs this, it needs this, it needs this, and they forget that they're getting a vehicle for a low price. So you pull that amount out of your income, which is possible to do under many circumstances. And again, in terms of choosing a vehicle, there are places that say, well, we're the charity, and here's how you donate a vehicle to us. Or there are places that say, we take in vehicles, and then we have several different charities. Pick one whom you would want the net proceeds to go. There is a special IRS publication, Kathy, up at IRS.gov on how to go about donating a vehicle to charity, and we'll put a link to that brochure up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
Kathy, I'm just curious, did you know that there is it's the Car Talk vehicle donation program that will benefit a local public radio station if you donate your car?
No, I did not, so I will look into that.
There we go. So, we have, I'm sure, information on WPR.org. our website, or just look up Car Talk Vehicle.
And then, as I understand it, the employee of the month gets to drive the vehicle. Is that how that works?
Yes. Okay. And if you that's what the kind of car I'm driving right now. You know. Actually, I did donate my vehicle, one of the older ones I had, and it was I did get a tax write-off, and public radio did get a donation, so that's very nice. Thanks very much, Kathy. I hope you decide to donate your vehicle to public radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network.
I know I'd go from rags to riches if you would only say you care.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with financial planner Kevin McKinley, welcoming your questions for him. We have an open line, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Sam in Madison is with us. Hi, Sam.
Hey, so my question is, I'm currently working a job in Madison, Wisconsin, but I'm applying to medical school, which is going to be 4 years of tuition and then probably another 4 years of residency where I'm not making nearly as much as I am now. So my question is, what is the balance between me investing my money right now in, you know, an IRA or some bonds and having that grow because I won't be making money for the next 8+ years versus saving that money and putting that toward my med school loans, which potentially wouldn't make, you know, that big of an impact.
Mm-hmm. I would I like your sentiments for lots of reasons, Sam. First of all, there is a physician shortage coming in America, so we need all that we can get, especially old people like Joy and,
yes,
and me. So thank you for doing that. And second of all, I like the notion of trying to figure out what to do with the money you have now. Here's what I would prefer that you do. I'd rather have you keep that money in a savings account, a safe place. And that means it's not going to make any money for you. Safe deposits and investments don't pay anything right now. But I want you to have that liquid so that if something comes up where you need the money or you want the money, maybe you get, you know, 2 hours off or something and you want to take a little break, I'd like you to have that money there for you. So you're not worried about it going up and down in the market or something, especially as the stock market is making all-time highs. I'd love to see it continue to do so and double in the next 5 years, but I don't think that's going to happen. And you're making a tremendous investment in your own economic well-being by taking on this debt and spending all this time in your prime earning years going to med school. I think it's very noble, and most people who have done this are very happy by the time it all comes out at the end. But it's going to be very grueling, and I want money worries to not be one of them. So I'd prefer that you actually keep whatever money you have set aside in a savings account and then borrow whatever money you need to get. You know, a lot of people talk about how disastrous it is to come out of med school with $100,000 or $150,000 of debt. And you can actually pay that debt off in 10 years by making 1% of the original balance in payments per month. So in other words, let's say you have $100,000 in debt coming out of med school. If you make $1,000 a month, that debt will be paid off in 10 years. And if you are not making enough to cover that, you probably picked the wrong specialty in med school. So $1,000 a month is a huge dollar amount, but your earnings will more than compensate you for that payment. So keep the cash aside, borrow whatever you can and whatever you need, and then and only after you're all done and you're actually earning the wage and salary you expect, then start worrying about investing and then also about paying the loans off at that time.
Great.
Okay, Sam?
Thank you so much.
All right.
Yep.
Thank you very much for the call. Let's take this email from BK. Is there a way to take an NUA and not pay any taxes on the distribution? As you know, an NUA involves taking your 401k distribution as company stock. Well, I did not know that.
Always presumptive.
Yeah. My question is based on a statement that you made recently on the tax owed on long-term capital gains, that it would be zero if one is in the 15% bracket. So can I get my taxable income on line 43 to the 15% bracket, including the value of the NUA? Then I will pay no tax on the stock portion of the distribution. Ooh, boy, this is getting a little complicated. Any potholes in this idea, he wants to know. Kevin, what do you think?
I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention. Could you read that again, please? No, it's actually it's a fairly sophisticated strategy, but it's not beyond the grasp of most workers, especially ones who would qualify for this. What happens is, let's say you work for a company, and as part of the investment option or reward in the retirement plan, they give company stock in the company that you work for. There's an option called net unrealized appreciation, which means that you can take the stock out of your IRA, all right? And you can transfer, or the 401k in this case, you can transfer the whole value out. And when that happens, you only pay taxes on the cost basis of the stock, meaning whatever it costs to purchase it over these many years that you might have had it. And then when you sell it, it's possible, as the BK says, to remain in the 15% federal income tax bracket and then sell the stock so that you don't pay anything in long-term capital gains tax. And it works best for people who are in a low to middle income tax bracket and also have a stock with a very low cost basis. Because again, let's say the shares that this listener purchased costs $1 per share for 100 shares. And let's say it's worth $10 a share now. All right, so they would transfer out 100 shares at $1 each, and they'd pay taxes on $100 of distribution from this plan. But then if they can sell that stock at that point, that $9 per share profit, if they're in the 15% federal income tax bracket, they don't pay any taxes on it whatsoever. So it's virtually almost a tax-free distribution. Whereas if they were to just take it out as ordinary income, they're going to pay full income taxes on whatever they pull out of it otherwise. So it's it's a tricky notion, but it can be done. We've done it in the past. And it's something that I would highly recommend. The dangers are that you'll sell so much stock that the capital gains will boost you up past the higher bracket. So if you're going to do this, you probably want to do it again in portions. So you do some of it in 2014 and some in 2015 to stay in those lower brackets. And then by doing that, though, by waiting, you're also taking the risk that the stock may depreciate, may go down in value, and whatever benefit you've gained by going through this maneuver, you're going to give up to the whims of the market decline. And so I'd be cautious about doing it, but I would definitely recommend the listener pursue it.
We have another comment on Facebook, a question Louise asks. My beautician and person who occasionally does my nails are essentially self-employed in that they rent a space with a group. What would the tip be in this case? Another caller wanted to know if we should tip our postal workers, our newspaper delivery people, or the people who work at buffets and clear the dishes. Mm. So you're getting all sorts of questions here on tipping.
Yeah, the answer to that on behalf of all of the people about whom they're asking is yes, and lots. The beautician, even the independent one or the self-employed one, I'd still go with the 20% rule of thumb, and then maybe an extra bonus session's worth of year-end tip at the end. You want to keep this person happy and make sure that they take as good a care of you as they possibly can. That's pretty standard. The buffet person, that's hard to find them because, you know, you might want to just leave the money on the table with it, even though they don't do quite as much work. I'll tell you what, I've been to buffets in the past, and based on the way some of us go through those plates, that's more work actually than bringing the plates of food out one time and then checking to see if anybody needs anything else. So I would tip that person as well. Definitely tip the newspaper delivery person by leaving a card out on the front for the person. And then finally, the postal carrier, probably not, in part because the way the Postal Service works, yes, you often have the regular driver, but there will often be a different person in there, and it's probably harder to find the regular person on the route for that particular tip in the year end. You can if you want, but I don't think that that's industry standard.
Yeah, you know, I looked that up once because I wanted to I don't know, season's greetings to John, my postal carrier. And I looked it up, and I thought it said that I wasn't supposed to give him cold, hard cash, that I could give him cookies or something.
Yeah, there is something about that as well. And then, of course, there's the issue of you know, if I were a postal worker and I got some cookies, I'd say, geez, did I forget to deliver something here?
You would not want my cookies.
Yeah, no, the dog gets those.
Yeah, it looks like the rules say cannot accept gifts of more than $20 on a single occasion. Oh, but you can give them gift cards. Okay, so now we know.
That seems fair.
We're talking about your money. And if you have a question about your money, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And it's time now for the smart assets portion of our program. Crowdfunding is putting a new spin on investing and fundraising, and you may start to hear more and more about it. What's the deal with crowdfunding, Kevin?
It's been around forever in one form or another, but it's taken on a new meaning with the social media and the internet allowing the facilitation of raising money for a particular product or a particular cause or whatever. Typically what happens is some of these websites set up a platform so that people can solicit donations for a product or a service or cause, and then the site processes all the payments for it and collects a 5% service fee, and then gives the net proceeds to the requester. Kickstarter, Indiegogo are two of the bigger ones too. A website called Fundable.com says that the average project that they've seen over the last few years raises $7,000, takes about 9 weeks to do, and the typical donors are younger, wealthier, more tech-savvy men who are willing to do this. But there are thousands of sites out there now that do this in one way or another. And the site said that Fundable said that there were $5 billion raised through crowdfunding in 2013. And then often people who donate get some sort of reward. Maybe it's, you know, a T-shirt or a coffee cup, or they get the actual product in many cases. They're saying, look, I want to design this product. I don't have the capital to do it and get the prototype built and everything. But if you donate X amount of dollars right now, you will be one of the first people to do it. And then there's typically some type of hurdle saying, look, if we don't get to $100,000 or whatever, everybody gets their money back, and we just pretend like this didn't happen.
So why is it that Wisconsinites might be hearing more and more about it?
Some new legislation just came in on June 1st that will allow Wisconsin companies to solicit Wisconsin residents to donate anywhere from up to $1 million or $2 million if the company has filed an audited statement that they can present to the Department of Financial Institutions and investors. And so Wisconsin residents who are interested in do this, or Wisconsin companies who want a different way to raise some money and bring it in, have a new option to do that. And the department, again, the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions is overseeing this particular portion of this new era in fundraising for state residents. And we'll have a link up to the DFI's website that explains a lot more about it, both for people who want to raise the money and for people who are considering investing in a company in this manner.
Do you think that we should look into this as an investment?
It's worth looking into as an investment, but I don't want people to go into this with money they can't afford to lose, and I don't want their expectations to exceed the boundaries of reality. Definitely investigate the company before you invest. Find out any figures that you can. Go through any audited statements that you can find. Bring them to a CPA to say, what do you think about this? Or a bank lender, if you know one who is willing to look at the company's financials. But most of all, if you do invest in any small business, don't do it if you expect the money back. Do it because you want to support the business or the cause, or you think the product might be interesting, but don't put any money in that you can't afford to lose. Don't be surprised by a disappointing outcome about it. Again, if you put $10,000 in, kiss that money goodbye, and then be pleasantly surprised if you do get anything back for it. And if you do choose to go with this kind of investing, or for any kind of money into a small business, you generally want to make, after making this kind of financial commitment, you want to make your other investments more conservative, because you've just taken on a tremendous amount of risk, and it can have a great deal of reward, but it's a great deal of risk. And so therefore, your other money that doesn't have anything to do with this investment should be more conservative.
Yeah. What about those who might want to raise money via crowdfunding?
It sounds good. and I hope it works out well. The legal loopholes and the issues can be daunting to a lot of people. There are limits on how people can solicit funds in terms of what kind of communication they have to provide, what they can't say to certain people. There are some tax issues in terms of how the money is raised and the filing for it. And remember, you've brought on, by bringing on investors, you've brought on part owners. And a lot of times people in this situation maybe own 1% of the company and they feel like they own 100% of the company, and they may demand more of you than if you just had a single partner who you were sharing a 50-50 ownership for it. I'd still prefer that people who can actually borrow the money, especially if they have some real estate that they can use as a backup for an asset and collateral for the loan, because bankers, as hard as they are to deal with, they're doing their jobs, but it's still easier to borrow money and deal with a lender afterwards than it is with an investor. So start with debt first, and then if you can't get anything done that way, then look at some type of platform that can bring investors on for you.
This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and our next caller is Bob in St. Germain. Hello, Bob.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I recently retired and started collecting Social Security. I am working part-time, about 20 hours a week, and what I'm wondering is, should I have federal withholding taken out of my Social Security?
Yeah, I would do that for a couple of reasons, one of which is that people generally do not like being surprised by a tax bill on April 15th versus being surprised by a refund. They'd much rather get the refund back for it. And the second reason being is that if you don't withhold enough, the IRS gets a little particular about that and says, okay, not only do you owe a small penalty for not withholding enough in the previous year, but you have to start filing quarterly estimates for it, meaning you have to start not only filing but also paying in an estimated quarterly income tax bill, and then the IRS will settle up with you at the end of the tax year or April 15th. So if you can afford to do it, Bobby, I'd rather have you withhold probably in the 15 to 20% range on the federal basis and 5% on the state or something like that if from any type of withholding you get in retirement.
Okay, I appreciate it.
All right, thanks for the call, Bob. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kevin McKinley is here to offer information and advice on your money. We'll have some tips coming up on shopping around for a new grill, and we have room for more of your personal finance questions, too, at 1-800-642-1234. What money matter is on your mind today? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network.
First from words of summer. Hey, there's something missing here.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And now that Memorial Day has come and gone, grilling season is officially underway. Kevin, did you have your first brat of the season?
we do brats year-round. We know that it's one of nature's most perfect foods. It's really all one needs to. It's got all the nutrients and vitamins that one can possibly need. As I see it, it's got fat. It has spices. What else do you need? No, we've had brats year round. But the good people at the Hearth Patio and Barbecue Association say that 80% of American households have a grill. 97% of them use it at least once per year. All of them actually run out of propane right when they need it the most. And in terms of the number of grills sold, 14 million grills are sold in a typical year in America usually. About 60% of those are gas grills, 35% are charcoal, and the remaining are electric grills, which that's not even grilling. I don't know why people would do that.
Who has one of those? Yeah. You know, it made me laugh because at one of our most recent cookouts, my brother-in-law fired up the gas grill and it immediately ran out of propane.
Of course, it's just a rule of thumb. If you're having a party, all of the propane is gone. You cannot have a party and propane at the same place.
And I'm sorry, I missed that because I was remembering that. So are gas grills lead the charcoal grills in terms of ownership? Or
yes,
no?
Absolutely. And the numbers first switched about 20 years ago in 1994 when the number was equal, number of gas grills to charcoal grills. But ever since then, we like our convenience, and they've got the prices down enough where a lot of people can afford a gas grill, and it's just a lot easier to deal with. I know purists say they don't get the char or the smoke, or that the wood chips are harder to use with a gas grill. That's true, but man, it's a lot easier than waiting for those that narrow window of proper heat on the briquettes with a gas grill. It's there the whole time.
Well, I'm afraid I don't have either. I don't have either, Kevin. I don't have a gas grill or a charcoal grill, but. For those who do have, especially the gas grill, how do we make sure we use this safely?
Clean the thing up, and especially if it's been sitting outside for the whole winter and the spring, you got to clear out the tubes. Bugs like to crawl in there, and if the tubes are clogged, in a good case, you're going to have a poor gas flow and a poor flame. In the worst case scenario, it'll back up, and you'll have lots of problems. You want to get all the residue off the grates, heat it up to the highest temperature you can get, and then start scrubbing for it. You generally don't want to use any chemicals around the grill if you possibly can, in part because of the residue cooked can impart to the food, and that can create a problem for you and your guests. You also want to run some bubbly solution, like a soapy solution, along the tubes of the gas tubes and see if you get any bubbles there while the gas is on to make sure there aren't any leaks in it as well. And as I mentioned, definitely get an extra tank and store it properly. Do not keep it near the grill. Tanks should not be anywhere where the temperature is going to get higher than 120 degrees. Keep it in the garage, keep it upright, and keep it in a cool, shaded place.
All right. And when we're ready to fire it up?
Yeah, keep the grill away from the house. Don't put it right up next to it, especially if you have, you know, vinyl siding or whatever. I've seen several tragedies. Thankfully, none have been completely dangerous, but where the grill has been on all day and melted the side of the house. Oh. And keep it away from traffic areas as well. Oil the grill up, the actual metal grates in advance so that the food won't stick to it. And then don't char your food. It's very dangerous to eat charred food, especially over a long period of time. Afterwards, you might want to crank up the burner on the gas grill as high as it can go again to burn all the residue off. Or if you have a self-cleaning oven and the grill can fit in there, you can pop it in there and that will burn the residue off as well. Finally, if you're storing it, make sure you get a grill cover for it because rust is a very big danger to new grills, and not just because they can wear out, but because the foundations, of course, can start to rot away, and the grill can just drop, especially if you've been moving it around or whatever, and it's been weakened that way. And again, you've got a hot thing that's falling all over the place with gas and flame. It's not a good situation.
All right. So what if it's a time for a new grill, or Kevin, what if we might want to buy a certain dad in our lives a new grill for Father's Day?
Father's Day is coming up, and this is a very good time to start looking for a new grill. The 4th of July and the selling season is when grills are the best price for the year, and especially gas grills, there's some good deals on. But you may not want to wait too long, in part because the inventory will dwindle down as Father's Day and the 4th of July come and go, but also because you may need to assemble this grill. That may take a while, and if you are planning some kind of event for Father's Day or for the 4th of July, you want to make sure that the grill works. So you want to take it out for a test run, make sure that everything's in place before the party starts.
Well, so if we spend a lot for an expensive grill, are we going to, have a better experience with our grilling?
You know, I hate to be gender specific here, but I've never had a woman brag to me about her grill, about the thing, the $2,800 and the stainless this and the this thing that does their taxes or whatever. But I've had several guys who said, come on out and take a look at this thing. And I'm like, heat. Meat, it still seems to do the same thing for $3,000. But yeah, for a few hundred dollars, you can get just about everything you could possibly want in a grill, as long as it has nice, even heat, plenty of room on the space for larger parties or larger pieces of meat. And the extras, you know, like the little burner on the top, that's just more hassle than it's worth. And if you really want to do that, you can buy a hot plate for like 10 or 20 bucks and plug it into an outlet outside and get the same effect.
So any particular brands that you think we should look for?
The lower-end models of grills are fairly similar, and many of them are actually made by the same factory and just with a different label slapped on it. But Consumer Reports recently ran a review of it, and they said the Charbroil infrared grills, which are sold at many larger big box stores in our area, go for about $200 to $400 depending on the model, and those got very good reviews from not only their testers but also their readers. And so one reason to keep an eye on the newspapers is those circulars are going to be full of really good deals on grills. And so keep an eye on those every Sunday.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine talking with financial planner Kevin McKinley, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Kevin is here just about every Tuesday at this time. We are live on Tuesday mornings. The program is rebroadcast on Tuesday evenings and once again on Sunday mornings. But if you have a question for Kevin, we have a rare open line at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. So let us know what personal finance question is concerning you today. Janet emails, while traveling to Australia and New Zealand, I was interested that we were told to not tip as the employees and servers made a living wage. If we paid our servers a living wage, I know that establishments will raise prices, but then everyone pays, not just those who are willing to tip. Any thoughts on that, Kevin?
I agree with her completely. I think and I think you're going to see more establishments do this. It's a risk, and it's kind of scary for them to say, hey, we're raising prices 20%, and then we're raising wages up to offset that amount, because most restaurants are really struggling right now, and business is good for some, but still margins are not – it's not a high-margin business, and it's generally not something where people easily get rich in it. So I'd like to see them do that and just explain to people what they're doing and why they're doing it. So you don't have to tip anymore. You don't have to go through this big, you know, story problem where, okay, let's see, we had five people and two drinks, but then we had the discount and the coupon, and so should we tip on that? Yeah. Yes, you should, by the way. And so I agree with her. I'd love to see that happen. There are some people, though, who don't like it. Some customers say, I like to have a little bit of risk in for the server so that I have control over how much this person makes, and therefore I can hopefully get, you know, to ensure promptitude is how the phrase tip allegedly came into place in the 16th century. And so that's the people have a basic need to want some control over the server to get some better service. But all in all, I think we'd all be better off if they just said, hey, we're going to pay these people $10 to $12 an hour or whatever they're going to pay them, but you don't have to tip.
Yeah, I do go to a hair salon that is a no-tipping salon, and it's really nice. The haircut costs more, and I'm presuming my stylist gets a little bit more.
You'd hope.
Yeah, and I don't have to tip.
Yeah, so. And I don't tip either. What I do is I just give personal financial tips. I write on the receipt, like, don't pay off your mortgage any faster than you have to, sincerely, Kevin.
Do people leave you a tip sometimes, Kevin?
That's a good point. I should have a jar out in the office.
That would be funny. we have Jason in Chippewa Falls with us. Hi, Jason.
Hi. I have my own company, and we're right now trying to figure out our distribution versus salary. I know if you give yourself a larger distribution and lower your salary tax-wise, it's beneficial. But my concern is, how does that affect my Social Security?
Yeah, it'll probably make out better in the long run. What Jason's talking about is business owners have the option of how they're going to take income within reason. And if they take their income as salary, of course, it's not only taxed as income, but they also have to pay in Social Security, Medicare taxes on that amount. And the good news is that the more money you take out and pay taxes on that way, the higher your benefit will be. You do save money if you take some of that as a dividend distribution, because it's taxed at a lower interest rate. Generally, the bad news is that dividend distribution generally is part of the reason it's a good idea to do it is because it's not taxed as Social Security, and for Social Security, and then therefore you end up with more in your pocket. It will hurt you in the long run, though, Jason, because you will have less in Social Security. In the short run, though, you will definitely pay less in taxes. One thing to watch out for: the IRS is very aware of this maneuver, and they don't mind it as long as you're paying yourself a salary that is fair. You can't say, "Well, I'm going to take $1 million $10 in a dividend and take $1 as a salary. They would prefer to say, what's your position? If you were the, you know, if you were to hire a, let's say, a general manager to run your business, what would be the wage to pay that general manager? And if it's, let's say, $60,000 a year, you should probably take $60,000 a year at least in salary. And then anything above that, you may be able to get away with calling it a dividend, but don't be surprised if you get a call from the IRS, say, hey, we just want to take a look at this because it seems like you're taking a lot of dividend income. Can we look at your business to see if it's fair, or do we need you to actually go back in and include more of that as salary?
Okay, Jason.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Erica emails, my husband and I carry no debt and have a nice savings account with middle-class incomes. The problem is we are so concerned about the what-ifs. What if the car dies? What if we lose a job? A furnace needs replacement, etc. That we just don't know how much cash to keep on hand and what to do with the rest of our money. Should we look to stocks or mutual funds or what, Kevin?
Well, I'd prefer that in that situation, first of all, they try to keep 6 to 12 months of living expenses set aside. And then second of all, with any extra money above and beyond that, they should save in pre-tax at-work retirement accounts, especially if they have decent income and not a lot of deductions for it. They're probably getting hit pretty hard with the tax bill. So they should max out their pre-tax retirement savings. And it's not as important that they what investment they use underneath. It's more important to actually get the tax break by making the contribution. After that, then go on to Roth IRAs, and those, again, can serve as ersatz savings accounts because you can pull the contributions to a Roth IRA back out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. But the earnings on the Roth IRA investments will be sheltered from taxes. And then in retirement, if you pull them out after basically after the age of 59 and a half, they're tax-free and the distributions may not affect the taxation of your Social Security benefits. Finally, for those what-ifs, I know several people who like to plan for those kinds of eventualities and create little envelopes where they put money or even separate bank accounts in where they call it the furnace account. And they might put in $20 a paycheck or something. And as it builds up over time, it might be several thousand dollars. And when the furnace goes wrong, they go, oh, shoot, well, this is why we created the furnace envelope. So we had a few thousand dollars to put towards the new furnace. And that helps not only cover the financial issues and make sure you don't spend it, but also the emotional setbacks of getting this kind of thing, which we all go through. But when it's a surprise and it's not a fun expense, it can be kind of dejecting to get hit with that out of the blue.
Let's take one last call. We're almost out of time, but this sounds like a perfect world here. Bob in Janesville, what do you want to recommend when it comes to a grill?
Well, there's a third type of grill, and that's kind of a hybrid. It's a propane. It's got a propane tank. I have one of these. Weber made it some years ago. It's got a small propane tank with an igniter. You pile charcoal in there and start the charcoal with the propane tank and a little igniter button that starts the charcoal. And then you cook with the charcoal. It starts the charcoal quickly. You get the benefit of cooking with charcoal. And I think it's the perfect world. I haven't seen these on the market lately. I know they were hot about 10 years ago.
Hot. I get it. Good one, Bob. I like that. And Joy, doesn't Bob sound like the guy who kind of guy who actually does know what he's talking about with this?
That's the name of my brother-in-law, too, Bob.
I'm always impressed with guys like this because I'm the kind of guy where we practically have to hire somebody like Bob to come and change our light bulbs.
Listen, we have barely time for the website of the week.
There is a comic book called Poorcraft, The Funny Book Fundamentals of Living Well on Less, and you can buy it on Amazon.com. It's a very nice, sensible, time-saving and decent way, especially for younger people, to learn how to enjoy life on less. But by going to Poorcraft.com, they're serializing the publication where people can see it for free. Poorcraft.com, and we'll put a link up to that website at our website, OnYourMoney.com.
We are both going to be off next week enjoying some vacations and tipping appropriately. But time for four more words before we go, Kevin.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And we'll be back 2 weeks from now together with another edition of On Your Money. Cynthia Schuster and another financial expert will be with you next week. This is the Ideas Network.